what I want to talk about is these objects called neutrinos, which have been in the news lately, but they've been in the news much longer, of course. So what are neutrinos? Quite a few years ago, I was talking to a friend of mine who is an artist, and I was telling him about neutrinos, and I was telling him, you know, there are all these things around us and we don't see them, and it's only lately that human beings have seen them, and they're really fantastic, but they were at some point very important. So to him, he came up with these three pictures. He's French, I mean, that's okay. But this first neutrino, and he went through a whole neutrino series, and I must admit, if I hadn't seen the title, I would not have known those were neutrinos. But nevertheless...
Which are the neutrinos?
Well, this is the first neutrino. This is a flirting neutrino, and this is a neutrino caught in an Argentinian tango. Why? I don't know. But he's an artist, that's why the guy is an artist and I'm not. Okay? But to us, they are crucial for the understanding of the basic workings of the universe. What I would like to talk about, since most people have forgotten or maybe never knew the history of these neutrinos, I will talk about the early neutrino and its history, how its properties have been determined experimentally. I will talk a little bit about theories of neutrino masses and mixing, and then I will talk in even less about the future. So first of all, I will concentrate on six neutrino pioneers. Of course, Wolfgang Pauli, Enrico Fermi, Fred Reines, Bruno Pontecorvo, Maurice Goldhaber, and Ray Davis. Those are the six people who basically, two of whom are still alive. Goldhaber is 90 years old, just a few to this 90th birthday, and Ray Davis is in his late 70s, I guess. So let us start this neutrino story. The father of the neutrino, as we all know, is a certain Wolfgang Pauli Jr., he was quite a fast learner, because only 3 years after the publication of Einstein's theory of general relativity, he wrote a review article. By today's standards, that's even awesome. People do that today, but it's much easier. And of course, he got the Nobel Prize. Now, it all started, his interest in the neutrinos all started in a letter that he wrote, having to do with the fact that he had a date and was excusing himself to a bunch of physicists. And this is what he said: "Dear radioactive ladies and gentlemen," which is what I would call a nerdy beginning to a letter, which, so you see, some things have not changed. "And I've hit upon a desperate remedy to save the exchange theorem of statistics," that means also known today as the Pauli exclusion principle, "and the energy theorem," mainly the fact that there was something wrong in beta decay, "that there could exist in nuclei electrically neutral particles which have spin 1/2 and do not travel with the velocity of light. The continuous beta spectrum would then become understandable." In other words, what he did, he dropped this guy into radioactivity. But then he said something remarkable. He said, "I do not feel secure enough to publish anything about this idea." But in other words, the letter was the equivalent of the archives. "And only those who can wager can win." And unfortunately, and then he says, he ends up in a rather unnerdy thing. He says, "Unfortunately, I cannot personally appear in Tübingen since I'm indispensable here on account of a ball." That's very unnerdy. Most physicists would do the other way around. And this is most unusual. But he had just divorced his first wife about 3 or 4 days earlier, formally. That is, and he has the date. And then, some of you probably know, he was in analysis for the rest of his life with Carl Jung, and he wrote actually a rather interesting book in the 1950s.
Why didn't he want a neutrino travel to
his life? Because he wanted it to have a mass, and he wanted it to be bound. How could it be bound? And he thought it could be bound by the magnetic moment. That's where the famous Pauli term comes from. Interestingly enough, by the way, Pauli, about 6 months later in Pasadena, there was a meeting of the American Physical Society at which he said that the neutron, as he called it actually, is a nuclear particle. Much later in life, he said, no, I never said that. Familiar. Plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. Now, so Pauli proposed to solve two problems, the Pauli exclusion principle and the continuous beta decay spectrum, but only with one particle. You see, in those days, I think what happened is that if you had to invent a particle, it was an admission of defeat, because you could not explain what was going on with the tools at your disposal. And even that was viewed weird. This is fantastic nowadays when you think that when there is anything, even a rumor, not only do you invent a particle, but you invent a Kaluza-Klein tower for it. So this is a century later. This is kind of a weird thing, okay? But nature, however, uses two particles. As you know, Chadwick discovers the neutron, which is the heavy nuclear particle which solves Pauli's exchange problem. What happened is that lithium and lithium-6 and nitrogen-14 nuclei were not behaving the way they should, and that without neutrons you would not understand it, okay? So now, the guy who got it right was Fermi, because in 1933 he says that Pauli's particle does not live in a nucleus, it is created and emitted during beta emission. That's a famous Pauli theory. And he said, c'è un neutrino, c'è un neutrino, so being Italian, and because neutron had already been taken by Pauli, although Pauli first used it, then Chadwick actually said it, this is the neutron. Okay.
Oh, Pauli actually invented the name neutron.
Yeah, yeah, it's in his letter. Mm-hmm. Now, the discovery. Now, this is something interesting. The discovery of the neutrino was done by two gentlemen, Frederick Reines and Clyde Cowan. Reines over here and Clyde Cowan over there. I want to go through their experiment because it's extremely ingenious. 26 years later they did this, so it took, between theory and experiment, it took 26 years. So, which is, unfortunately, a long stretch human beings have not scaled their lives to such long things.
You see, nowadays, the experimentalists who did the first experiment with the spectrum would have taken credit for the...
That's true too, yeah. Of course. Well, I don't want to talk too much about experimentalists because you know that experimentalists first thought that the beta spectrum was continuous. Lise Meitner and von Baeyer and company thought it was continuous. Then Chadwick, actually, a very young Chadwick, measured it and found him to be discrete in 1914. But he was in Geiger's laboratory and he was interned for the war. And then, so the controversy kind of died, and then started again. But then people found that the average energy emitted by the electron was much less than the available energy, etc. And then eventually it became clear there was a problem. And that was very serious, by the way. Debye said that's a problem he didn't want to think about, like the new taxes,
right,
etc. I mean, this was a really big problem.
Well, another footnote is that this is how Landau got thrown into jail, because he said that energy is not conserved, but Lenin said energy.
Is that right? Well, he should have been thrown to jail. There wasn't energy is concerned. Lenin was right in this case. Okay. All right. So 26 later is the ingenious experiment to detect antineutrinos. So an antineutrino hits a proton and a positron is emitted as well as a neutron. Now what happens to a positron emitted in a foreign land? It annihilates almost immediately. In a process, two photons come flying out. Okay? But the neutron though, okay, these are the two photons. The neutron, though, is absorbed, starts wandering around being electrically neutral, but they put a lot of cadmium in their thing, and that has a high absorption cross-section for the neutron, and the cadmium absorbs it, but the emission is three photons, so three photons plus all kinds of stuff come out. So what do you look for? You look for two photons following by three photons, and you look for time coincidences of this. And that's how they discovered it. It's a very beautiful idea. Okay? Now, Fred Reines earns much later, 1995, a free trip to Stockholm.
And Cowan died.
Cowan died in 74. I just checked. I don't know of what. I mean, he was in his 50s at the time. But this is this was finally acclaimed. And unfortunately, Fred Reines was beginning to fight Alzheimer at the time that he got the prize. And he cashed in, but a bit too late in his life. Sorry. This is just because I've gone a bit crazy with PowerPoint. Now, neutrino spin. The next thing is, what is the spin of the neutrino? Another exceedingly ingenious experiment. It has to do with S-wave electron capture. What happens, it's a tabletop experiment. You have a certain nucleus, which is in its ground state, a good nuclei are. And it captures an electron, and in so produces another nucleus in its excited state and a neutrino. And the excited state guy decays to its ground state. Now, if the emission of the photon takes place right after this first reaction, there's no time for the recoil of the guy hasn't come out. And what happens is that you get more events that way, which is called the resonant X-ray scattering, which means actually, although the neutrino and the photon will come out back to back, although you don't see the neutrino, but you can measure the photon. So the idea is that if you know the spin of the nuclear states and you measure the photon helicity, you find the neutrinos, and you find they have spin 1/2 and left-handed helicity, always left-handed helicity. And that experiment, which is brilliant, was performed in 57 by Goldhaber, Godsin, and Sunyaev. Just a very, very beautiful experiment.
So that's 57, so that's parity violation too.
Yeah. Well, that was a little bit after, but right. The fact is that the neutrino is the first particle that is truly chiral, that is purely left-handed in nature, mm-hmm. up to perhaps what the recent developments. Okay? Now, let's backtrack to 1945. Pontecorvo, you know, who was at that time in Canada, at Chalk River, proposed a very clever way to detect neutrinos. And this is a famous reaction now. So a neutrino comes in, hits chlorine 37, and can actually make a transition to argon 37 plus an electron. Now, that is the recipe for what is called, in South Dakota, a neutrino catcher. What you do, as long as the energy of the neutrino is greater than 0.8 MeV, because that's how much energy you need to cause the transition, you fill up a tank with cleaning fluid, chlorine. Okay. You count the number of argon atoms once a month that are produced. How can you do this? Well, the beauty of Pontecorvo's idea is that the argon is, of course, inert, chemically inert, so it can stay around without doing damage to the environment, very California-like. But it is mildly radioactive, so you can detect it. So you basically take the cleaning fluid, clean it out, and then count. Okay? Fermi thought this was not practical. So Pontecorvo, this I get from a former student of Pontecorvo, who told me that Pontecorvo went to Fermi, and Fermi said, yeah, it's fine, but you'll never measure it. And so it was never published. And to this day, it is a preprint. From Chalk River. I mean, it's the way it is. And in those days, a preprint really meant that they didn't really believe in it. I mean, nowadays it doesn't mean very much, but it's different. Okay. But Ray Davis Jr. had other ideas. What he did, he first set up a tank outside a reactor, which happened to be in the Carolinas, outside the Savannah. By the way, the antineutrino was first found by Reines and Cowan outside the Savannah River Plant reactor. In the American South, where I'm a southern boy now, so I've got to say that. Same thing here. He sets up a tank of cleaning fluid, a very small tank outside a reactor, and he finds argon. And how could that be, since really, basically, antineutrinos should come out of reactors, not neutrinos, and people... And that was the days of the KK-Bauer oscillations. And so Pontecorvo right away suggested those are oscillations. In that case, the rumor went away, because they hadn't found anything, but the idea stayed. Of oscillations.
You mean the experimental rumor?
The experimental went away. The experimental data went away. So in that case, the rumor actually carried information with it, even though it traveled faster than the speed of light. So what he does the next time, he puts a bigger tank deep underground in a Homestake gold mine in lead, which is pronounced lead, I'm told, even though this is a Dakota thing. I don't understand this. Okay. So this is the early graduate students, actually. This is from some website, I forgot which one. These are the early miners of the actual gold mine, I am told. Okay, I'm told. I mean, I stole that, pirated that from some website. But actually what he did, he just set up a tank. This is the cleaning fluid. Okay, and then he aims to count neutrinos from the sun. Now how is that? Because the sun emits lots of neutrinos. So this is a quick reminder of how the sun emits neutrinos. Well, these are the energy of the neutrinos emitted by the solar core. One come from the fusion reaction. Several come from beryllium lines, some PEP. I'll explain this a little. And then the most energetic ones here, in some amount, come from the boron 8 decay. And this I won't talk about. The first one are the proton fusion with the, and but it's most of them, and that one actually really tells you about the temperature of the sun. But then, after having done that, well, you have a long chain of events, and the long chain of events gives this PEP reaction, beryllium lines, and then finally boron decay, which comes at the end of a long chain. So you really have to know the abundance of the boron, which is a highly doubtful quantity, except some theorists think they know it. Okay, and what happened is that this was something that could be actually detected with the right size. And again, Davis went to Maurice Goldhaber, who was then director of Brookhaven, and asked, he wanted to set up a pilot experiment with this stuff. And Maurice said yes, and they did, and then they went on to the mine. What happened is that this is the right energy for Pontecorvo's reaction, and Bacall had shown some nuclear physics at the time that actually enough boron was produced by the sun. So both Bacall and Davis went to Goldhaber with this. Now, at that point, let's introduce the solar neutrino unit, the SNU, which is 10 to the minus 36 captures per atom per second. The theorist behind this is John Bacall. At the time, he was inside a cave, too. I think those pictures were taken inside the gold mine. And there were predictions and et cetera, et cetera. And he expected something like 7.7 SNUs. And after a quarter of a century of data taking, starting in 1968, sometimes the community, by the way, Ray Davis is a chemist. And the community basically thought, what does a chemist know about doing such things? He has something like 10 to the 36 chlorine atoms, and he's got to have a count of a few argon. And how is he going to be able to count a few argon out of this? People said he was kind of, you know. And so the community was very ambivalent. Willie Fowler went so far as to say at some point maybe the sun had turned off, jokingly, I think. Okay, but at some point he was not even funded. So there's a gap in the data. Okay, he finds much less, by one-third the expected rate, and since 1968. Okay, that was a great discovery, I thought, and it could become a greater one, perhaps. God, I'm sorry, I don't know how to stop this sound. Now, after that, two more experiments have also found a solar neutrino deficit, but this time in the low-energy fusion neutrinos, one in a former Soviet Union, SAGE, and one in GALAX. SAGE was Soviet, blah, 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 etc. Now, if it's RAGE, it is now Russian, so it is RAGE. But the results stand, and they seem to confirm. Now, at that point, something fantastic happens, which is one of those things that, neutrino physics comes out, is that the 1987 A supernova. 1987 was an important year. There was a supernova. This was before and after. By the way, this is from the Australian stuff, and since they drive on the wrong side of the road, the before is on that side rather than that. But that's okay. Okay? And we think we understand a little bit about supernovas, and because we understand eventually there are beautiful rings forming. This is from Hubble much later, etc. These are pretty pictures, and this is what you give to funding agencies. But what happened is that we also knew from these theories that they expected to be a neutrino burst. And a neutrino burst coming from these things was pretty well. It was a prediction of theory. Now, what happened is that at that time, coming from grand unified ideas, etc., there have been two proton decay detectors on the ground, lots of stuff with phototubes around, just waiting there for the proton to decay. They're still waiting, by the way. But okay. And what happened? Suddenly, it turns out that these guys become neutrino decay detectors. Well, I should say, decay is not right, but neutrino detectors, because what has happened is that they were able to detect the effect of the neutrinos going through their detector by basically having a neutrino hit an electron electron comes out, Cherenkov light, etc., phototubes turn on, beautiful rings, life is happy. And both detectors, one called IMB, which was in Ohio in a salt mine, and Kamioka, that's the in Japan, the neutrino detector experiment. So Kamioka is the name, NDE is the stuff, and they detected this, and that was quite beautiful. Talking of Kamioka, they went on. You see, it used to be a day where Japanese used to build things smaller, you know. Okay, now they have learned, and they're building stuff bigger. Japanese cars are getting bigger, but their detectors are getting bigger too. So they built this stuff, which is the same thing as Kamioka, except bigger. Okay, that's a detector that is inside the Kamioka mine. By the way, if you have ever been in that mine, it's very disappointing because you drive into it horizontally. You know, it's none of these ideas of people full of, you know, dark coal dust, et cetera, you know, going down into the bowels of the earth. This, no, you drive in a little truck, you know, kind of horizontally. Olmsted and actually Sudbury is like that. Those are real men's minds. This is kind of a sissy type mind, okay? All right? I mean, a designer mind, kind of, you know? This kind of stuff that Hollywood would think of, okay? So there it is. This is the tank, and what you have here is that there's water in there, relatively pure, and phototubes all around. Unfortunately, as you may have heard, a lot of these phototubes are gone now, but not for this experiment, okay? And this is in a very beautiful region of Japan, which is the Japanese Alps. Inside, this doesn't look good. Now, what do they detect? They were built to detect proton decay, really, to start with. But then after the neutrinos, they were built for the solar neutrino. But to everybody's surprise, they became very good at detecting these atmospheric neutrinos, which are byproduct of cosmic ray showers. What happens? Well, this is the Earth, I guess. This is Super K. And the Earth is hit isotropically by cosmic rays. Cosmic rays cause all kinds of particles to be produced, in particular pions. Pions decay preferentially into muon plus muon neutrinos, or antineutrinos, whatever it is. But then the muon decays into electrons, which contain both an electron and a muon neutrino. So you get two muon neutrinos for one electron neutrino. So the rough ratio is 2:1, which is indicated by the size here. Okay? So you see all these guys are coming through. And the results are that the number of muon-like neutrinos that you get from this stuff is about the same as the number of electron-like neutrinos, which is kind of weird because the ratio should be 2:1. The number of upward muons turns out to be different from the number of downward muons. So there's your detector. It's something like a few kilometers from the Earth on one side and basically the Earth diameter from the other side. You should get kind of the same if nothing happens to them, but you get the same here. Okay, the number of upward muon is different, and they should be the same naively because they go through the Earth. Neutrinos go through everything. Okay. Also, they found, and this was much more incredible, that was announced at their conference in 1987, that the number of the flux depended on this angle. So if a muon neutrino traveled more than another one, there was a different amount of flux. And that was the signature, okay, this for basically oscillation. So this is, if you fit this, these are things from Hank Sobel, if you fit, for example, some events like this, you would expect naively something like this, and then you get something like that. And the experiment has been getting better and better. And these people have had actually a 5 to 7 standard deviation effect in neutrino physics, which is unheard of. Neutrinos are hard to find, hard to do anything with. So it suggests that muon neutrinos oscillate into other flavors. That I got from Maury Goodman. Okay. So, but that means that neutrinos have different masses. That's also a great discovery. I don't know how to avoid this one. I think the sound is too much. But I hope these discoveries will be rewarded at some point. This is both a very big thing. So let's talk about two flavor oscillations. So a muon neutrino oscillates into a tau neutrino, for example. That is what this atmospheric stuff. And there's this celebrated formula, the probability of that basically a new mu goes into a new tau, proportional to the mixing angle. And then another parameters, the energy of the neutrino, the length the beam has traveled, and the mass square difference. And what people find, this is the result from Super K, is that it looks like, after a long series of analysis, that the muon goes into the tau. This is mostly by the fact that it goes into an active neutrino, namely one of the weakly interacting neutrinos, but it cannot go into the electron because there are bounds from a reactor in the north of France from that cold show. I don't have time to go into that. But the mass difference square is of that order. But interestingly enough, the angle becomes very big. That is something which to some was a surprise. To some of us, it was not that one at any rate. So this is more data. It's boring. And you can't read it in any way. But Super K, of course, detects solar neutrinos. That's what it was really, you know. So in that case, it's something like this, right? You have neutrinos coming from the sun. Of course, they're much, much lower energy. Okay? And they're detected through this reaction, the elastic scattering reaction. Okay. What do they do? Well, they confirm the deficit. There is a deficit there. There's not as much as expected from theory. And that has a great advantage. This solves finally a problem that is probably 10,000 years old, which is, where does the sun go at night? Right? I mean, ancient man, that was a source of concern, and you know that people spend a lot of energy praying to make sure it came up the next morning, because you never knew. So that's important. Finally, we know. Okay. The other one, we even know on a cloudy day where it is at all times, which in some parts of the world is equally important. In England, but also in Canada. Which brings me to the Canadian neutrino detector. Now, the Canadians set up a Super K-like thing, except this is a little bit different there, something called the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory in the town of Sudbury, which is a mining town. It's a town where physicists don't want to be seen at night. I mean, this is a rough town. This is really like a Jack London type of town. They finally came up with results last year. For a long time, it was known as still not operating. But that tells you something about the complexity of these experiments. These things, the level of purity that's needed into these various things is incredible. What they have heavy water in there. And this is, by the way, I think the U.S. government never wanted to part either with its gallium or heavy water, what they call strategic things. So even though you would give it back, you know, you don't use much of it. But no. So all these things have been done, not in the United States as a result. So there's deuterium in this inner chamber here. There's water here. And what they do, they look at, oh, yes, I can't resist, because this one came out, right? This is a view of the vessels. This is just pretty. If you show this to your artist friends, I mean, they would think that's nice. Never in a million years would they think this has to do with a physics detector, God forbid. Okay? What do they do?
What's the size of Sudbury compared to Super K?
Oh, I don't know. A bit smaller, I think.
Just a bit?
I think it's a bit smaller, yeah. Yeah. But a bit, I don't know. I don't have it off. Okay. So what they do, they look at the dissociation of deuterium by neutrinos. Forms two protons and an electron. Now, this reaction goes by charge W boson exchange only. It's a charge reaction. Okay? This is to be contrasted with the neutrino elastic scattering that basically Kamio Kande does. Because that goes both by W and Z, excuse me, not that Z, the Z boson exchange. Okay? And this one, so therefore it's a bit more complicated. The other one goes only by W.
But Sudbury received this also, of course. They also.
Well, of course, yeah. Yeah, that comes, okay? So, in June of 2001, they gave their first results. Their elastic scattering agrees with Super K, not with the same statistics, because they really don't have the same statistics, but it's in the same ballpark, okay? And then, you see, the trouble is that the deficit that Super K sees in elastic scattering contains both W boson and Z boson, but Z boson is flavor independent. So even though it's a smaller cross section, it is flavor independent. So it's not as clean. Whereas in a charge current, which is purely W production, they do see an electron neutrino that's going to cause that, and no one else. And you do see a suppression of this. And the suppression is amazingly consistent with the theoretical computations. Okay? So they say there's a fewer solar nuis at the detector. And therefore, the conclusions between these two guys is that the solar neutrino electron deficit has been confirmed. The solar neutrino electron flux has been confirmed as well. They mean that it is, okay? And that makes some theorists very happy. Because this theorist, among others, has been saying for a long time that his calculations and others actually were pretty stable. And then people said, well, but you know, the amount of boron depends on some god-awful power of the temperature, and if you just tweak the temperature a little bit, the amount of boron will change very, very badly, etc. But no, this seems to be like this. So the picture looks that way. The electron neutrino oscillates. They don't know quite into what kind. It's consistent with it oscillating into this kind of guy. This time the mass difference squared is much smaller, and the angle is also large, it seems. Namely, the results that are coming out. Snow is going to come out with a paper very soon, actually, which seems to there are other technicalities, but that angle also seems to be large. Not as large necessarily as the other, but they don't. But the indications are like this. So, what is the next stage of snow? Now, snow was actually designed not to do super K all over again, but it was designed to do something different. And what was the different things to do? Well, what they wanted to do was to enhance neutron detection. Well, chlorine has salt. They put salt in the detector, not natural salt. I'll tell you a cute story. I was talking to Gell-Mann about this, and I said, well, you know, they're going to season their detector with salt, and then they're going to enhance the capture cross-section for the neutron, and you know, this will be very interesting, blah blah blah. And they said, what are they going to do about the iodine? I said, I didn't say iodine. Oh, but he said, you said table salt. I forgot whom I was talking to. So I stood corrected. What happens is this. So a neutrino dissociates a deuteron, but through a neutral current. So now you have a proton and a neutron. So if you can detect this guy, okay, you can start talking about how many times this happens. Okay? This is only through Z boson exchange only. Therefore, it does not know flavor. It's flavor independent. Okay? So therefore, it counts the number of active neutrinos. Because it doesn't care if a neutrino starts from the sun as an electron neutrino, as it must, and if it changed into a muon neutrino, it will cause that reaction. Or if it changed into a tau neutrino, it will cause that reaction too. So you count the number of neutrons in the ideal world, you'll know how many neutrinos, active neutrinos, are coming from the sun.
Okay? So the salt is only to detect the neutron.
Yeah. Well, this is stage one. Stage two, they might have some helium-3 rods they're going to lower into it. And then when a neutron hits the helium-3, it'll transmit to another helium, etc., etc. That's more sophisticated. But at the moment, that's what they're doing. They've already done that. They are taking data. But, you know, it's a natural source, so the data doesn't come very often. I don't know the details. I would be surprised. Actually, no, I don't know.
It's gaseous
because liquid is... Yeah, it's gas. Okay, so... What happens if an electron neutrino comes in, you get that reaction. If a muon comes in, you get that reaction. Tau neutrino, you get that reaction. So no matter what it is, you count the number of neutrons. Assuming you can count neutrons, experimentalists in the audience might know that neutrons are the hardest thing in the world to count. Well, yes, they're neutral. Life is difficult. So that will yield the absolute normalization of the solar neutrino flux. Now it's time for theory. So I've given you an overview right now of the various experiments which have come out.
When they have produced data for stage one, stage two?
Stage one?
Yeah, when?
When? Well, the data, the charge current dissociation, that's done. Mm-hmm. This one, I don't know, probably by maybe this summer they might have something to say. I mean, the snow people. Now, Super K has just been put out of commission by this terrible accident. So right now they are the only game in town. I will talk a little bit later about some other aspects of neutrino stuff. In a standard model, it's very simple. Neutrinos are massless. And yet we have seen there is credible evidence that they have mass now. The standard model as defined by what people wrote in the 1960s. However, this is almost true, because we know, and as the standard model, if it's wrong, it's not wrong by much, because so far it has withstood all experimental tests. The direct mass limits on the various types of neutrinos are pretty stringent when you compare them with the charged partners. Okay, so whatever they are, they're tiny, and that's going to be a big question. How do you generate tiny masses? Now, in a standard model, these three neutrinos are parts of weak doublets. Okay, so we know they're quantum numbers. In other words, they have a weak hypercharge, third component of weak hypercharge, plus 1/2. Now, out of this, you can form what is known as a Majorana mass, which is a product, which is, of course, a bilinear fermions, and it has the quantum numbers that it violates weak isospin by 1 and lepton number by 2. That is one kind of mass you can make. Now, therefore, such a mass would be allowed if the standard model violates lepton number. And in fact, if it violates, it does not. That's why there is no such mass. However, if it did, quantum corrections would give you a dimension 5 operator, which, after all is said and done, would be like a Majorana mass times this, where capital M would be whatever the cutoff of the theory is, of the standard model, okay, whatever is the highest scale that occurs in the thing. And M would be a normal mass, like a quark mass or a lepton mass. So there would be some sort of a suppression mechanism that way. So the question is, how do you break the lepton number? Well, you can do it in various ways. Who carries lepton number? Well, you can have spin 1/2 or spin 0 particles. So you can do it with new scalars that you add to the model, or you can do it with new fermions, and of course, a combination of both. Okay. So let me first start with an example with new scalar. So this is a weird model, but it has one new scalar which couples, which is a charge plus one, right, as a charge scalar, which couples to the regular lepton doublets, and it couples to the Higgs in this way. So mu is actually an object which has mass. It's a mass scale you put in the thing here. But there is no mass generated at tree level in this model. And in this model, the Majorana mass is generated at one loop. So the scale of the mass is this scale mitigated by the one loop effect. Okay, and this model is known as the Z model. I don't know if... Did you work on this?
Long time
ago. Okay. I didn't know if you remembered. Yes. Yeah. Okay, good. And I just checked. This model is about now 330 citations, and it's become very popular in the press lately. I mean, in the archive press. Okay. Now, another way to do this is to have new fermions. If you have new fermions that you add, okay, then you can actually form what is known as a neutrino Dirac mass, which goes as follows. You have the regular neutrino, and then you have this new guy here, and that is called the right-handed, sterile because it has no electroweak quantum numbers. Okay, and this mass looks that way. It violates weak isospin by 1/2, and you give these guys the right... Well, actually, I should have put a bar here. It does not violate lepton number. Notice that the Dirac mass has the same quantum numbers, has quark and charged leptons. Yet we know experimentally that the mass of neutrinos, whether it is Majorana or Dirac, is much less. Okay. So how come much smaller? That's a theoretical puzzle. Now, one bright idea from string theory, I come here at Santa Barbara, and I didn't realize that Hawking's birthday was this week, but David Gross is not here, so I was in fear of my life, and therefore I thought I should really mention the S word once. Well, one idea that came from string theory through many, many different sociological Byzantine paths, I should say, but anyway, it does come from string theory. We live on a sheet, which is called the brain, floating in a bigger space, which is called the bulk. So the idea would be that there's a brain here, and there's a bulk everywhere else. Okay, why not? So it would make us feel even better. We'll be like flies stuck on wallpaper, you know? We feel even better about this somehow. But anyway, okay? So the normal fields, such as neutrinos and electrons and stuff like that, left-handed neutrinos, would live on the brain. And then the other guys, these right-handed guys, would be off the brain, off the wall, so as they say. Okay? And that is, and therefore, that Dirac mass that I've been talking about would be a brain bulk coupling. And a brain field, okay, a field on a higher dimensional space has different dimensions from a field on the brain. So the brain bulk coupling would have, mass factors and stuff like that. And so there will be actually a geometrical reduction of the coupling. So one idea which has come around is that actually you could maybe have just a Dirac mass, okay, very small, and maybe the reason it's small is because of this geometrical effect. This is only true if capital N has no Majorana mass, because capital N can have a Majorana mass. So then you have to invoke what I would call mumbo-jumbo, modulini, I don't know, some words, and you start saying it doesn't have a mass. Another way is to, this is what a Majorana mass would be for this guy. This guy has got nothing. Now, usually a guy that has got nothing, no quantum numbers, is as heavy as the cutoff of the theory wants it to be, because there's nothing to suppress it, to keep it down. So, therefore, it could be very large. And maybe its mass, for all we know, if it's there, maybe actually it's measuring for you the actual cutoff of the standard model. So let's say what we can do with both masses. With both masses, we can have Dirac mass. This is called the Majorana mass matrix, which is symmetric. We have both masses, both Dirac masses here, the Majorana mass of this of the right-handed guy. Okay. Oh, there they are. You know, I've gone crazy with this PowerPoint, I must say. I've learned this. I was telling Tony, I learned this from my youngest daughter. Well, two of my daughters are in science. One is in chemical physics. The other one is in genetics. And they're both PowerPoint. I mean, their communities seem to be PowerPointing like mad. But to me, PowerPoint used to be like, you know, I thought it was very, very elaborate Bill Gates type stuff, and I didn't want to have any part of it. But actually, you can get rid of all the Bill Gates and just put the regular equations. But in the process, you do go crazy. You get carpal tunnel. You get everything. And you get rich. If M is very big, you can diagonalize. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to diagonalize this. You find that one eigenvalue, if this guy is much bigger than this guy, one eigenvalue is small and this eigenvalue is small and the other one is large. I didn't put three guys here. But so the small eigenvalue is a normal Dirac mass suppressed by small m over capital M. But what is that? That small m over capital M, small m is a measure of the scale of electroweak breaking, which we know for Fermi's constant to be of the order of 250 JeV. This is a scale we know nothing about. So that has a virtue that we know nothing about that scale. But we know that this is a suppression. So this experimental suppression that we see actually tells us that this scale might be very large. In particular, if the Majorana neutrino mass is of the order milli electron volts, okay, then a mass of the order 10 to the 16 JeV would be fine, give or take many things. By the way, at that point, I'm putting errors in the exponent, just like cosmology. Okay, you know the story about cosmology and errors. This is true. Gamow's paper, he wrote an erratum to one of his papers, and he said in equation 12, the equation that said that R equals 10 to the plus 52 should actually say 10 to the minus 52. In no way does this affect the conclusions of the paper. Okay, all right. So, interestingly enough, that's a scale that which people in different types of physics like, because if you naively continue the standard model couplings with low-energy supersymmetry, they unify roughly there. But low-energy supersymmetry tells you that there's something going on soon in terms of experiment. Is it a coincidence? We don't know. We'll find out. Now, let's talk a little bit about quark-lepton relations now. Why is it? Now, we know that this idea of grand unification, for example, and stuff like that, we know that there are relations between quarks and leptons. Let's talk about the origin of the mixing matrices for a moment. The quark mixing matrix, which is called as the Kabibo-Kobayashi-Maskawa matrix, is a product of the mixing matrix of the charge minus one-third sector times the dagger of the charge two-thirds. So it is the mismatch between the mixing of the minus one-third and the mixing of the two-third. Experimentally, expanded in terms of the Kabibo angle, which is about 0.2 lambda, it's almost diagonal. That means that the charge two-third and minus a third quarks mix the same way, roughly speaking, to first approximation. Let's look at the lepton mixing matrix. The lepton mixing matrix, called MNS after the Japanese who first wrote the Maki, Nakagawa, and Sakata, first wrote the theory of flavor mixing among neutrinos, before Kabibo even, and they even did it in the quark sector, and they, Wes Pontecorvo talked more about what I would call neutrino anti-neutrino oscillation. These guys talk about. So I always advocate now that this matrix be called the MNS, just like the other one be called the CKM, because they actually deserve the credit for that one.
Oh really?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. What happened? This is very interesting. This is where politics. You were talking about Lenin. This is where politics comes in.
Right.
Sakata, you know, was very left mover. Was a quite chiral. In some sense. And he had this idea of democracy among particles, among everything. So he always talked about mixing. Everybody had to mix. And so the idea of this was, it was well before his time, because we know that everything mixes now. And so in Nagoya, he had this school of people around him, those people here. So mixing was a natural thing. But interestingly enough, I don't know if you know, but Kobayashi and Maskawa came from the Nagoya school, of course, a generation later. But the idea is the Japanese tend, I mean, there is still, you know, there's still Sakata's office in Nagoya University, you know, which is kept open, it's kept closed and everything else. So the idea of mixing, etc. So except for Kabibo, the whole damn mixing scheme came from Nagoya.
But what I don't understand about Kabibo is that also before Kabibo's paper,
Gell-Mann and Levy.
In a footnote.
That's correct. Well, in fact, this paper of Maki, Nakagawa and Sakata quotes Gell-Mann and Levy.
Oh, so Gell-Mann and Levy even before the Japanese.
Oh yes,
yeah.
1960.
Gell-Mann,
yeah,
mix,
yeah, they do.
The
yeah, well, I think Gell-Mann has enough credit.
I think.
Now, but you know, but to be fair with Kabibo, what was important was the so-called Kabibo universality,
mm-hmm.
Cos squared plus sine squared equals one. So there was more to it than just that. But you know, so anyway, you've got two, just like there, you have two guys here, okay? And what we know is that super K tells us that this angle phi is large. It's not, you know, the okay? That's where the atmospheric stuff, this is the mixing between the muon and the tau. And the latest results from Super K and Snow tend to say that actually the other angle here is relatively, is not bad either. It's not trivially small, it's not Kabibo suppressed. This angle here is tested, there is an experiment in France that's outside a reactor called Shaw, which seems to indicate that this matrix element is much suppressed with respect to these others, although there is no direct value, it's just a bound. Okay? So what we know, what is very interesting, is that this matrix is very different from the unit matrix. Okay? So that means the charge and neutral leptons mix differently, unlike the quarks of different charges. Okay? It looks more like this. U minus 1 looks more like mixing these guys here, and U0 mixing those guys, although since you only observe the product, there is no real way of knowing.
Yeah, I don't know.
Exactly. So you have to put in theoretical prejudices then. So grain unification, for example, implies the following. In SU5, the minus one-third charge matrix of the down quarks and the minus one charge matrix are related by transposition in a naive SU5. In a naive SO10, the charge two-third and charge zero are related. But this is only true, of course, for the Dirac mass. If the neutrino mass, the neutral neutrino mass, have to go through this funny mechanism, then that's more complicated. So, we think therefore U0 is generally unconstrained by quark lepton unification. Remember that this is how this guy goes. These are the Dirac masses, right? And this is the unconstrained Majorana mass. This is the mixing. So it's more complicated than that. The relationship is not that clean. And as Okay, let me go back here. still more. So basically where we are now is that we're in a situation which is that experimentally neutrino mixing is an established fact, I believe. We don't know how to measure. We don't know everything yet about it. We know that the patterns, I will actually tell you that the large angle, yet because this is a colloquium and this is late, I will not say that, but I believe the large angle from the super K is something that makes sense to me, even makes sense even before the data was known. The second large angle makes very little sense to me, much harder to accommodate. But whatever it is, it doesn't matter. The question is that this is a big surprise, and that all these parameters are a little bit weird. They're not exactly like the quarks, okay? Even though we know that quarks and leptons are intimately connected, if nothing else, through anti-anomalies. Okay? So this is where we are. So now, let me talk about...
So you show those granularified
dimensions,
but they're not preserved by the normalization group.
Well, it depends, but it depends whether they have to do with SU3 or not, because the renormalization group for SU2 is kind of mild. So it's only on, but if you look at mass ratios, it'll be okay, because the renormalization effects on the top and on the bottom will cancel out. There will be some, but it will not be violent. Like, for example, extrapolating a quark mass, which then is... So what it means is that all this new experimental flurry means that new fundamental parameters appear in a standard model, three mixing angles, just like in a CKM matrix, one CP violating angle. If it's a Majorana mass, basically there will be two more, and there are three masses of neutrinos. But now let me tell you, in this one, the three mixing angles, two have been measured and one is bounded. Measured, I don't know. The latest Snow result indicates a certain range. You have to understand that measured in this game means it's, you know, it's there, more or less. Okay? Now, the CP violating angle, that, if it could actually be seen only if you have a very intense beam of neutrinos, and people have been bandying around the idea of a neutrino factory, which would come from trapping lots of muons and making basically a muon storage ring, and then waiting for the muon to decay and get lots of neutrinos. And there's a whole community that's really, you know, whenever you have the name factory, you must put the word CP with it. Like, you know, regular CP violation is the B factory, this is the neutrino factory, etc. Okay. Now, these two more Majorana masses come from the fact that the Majorana mass violates lepton number. So their effect will be actually, turns out, would be further suppressed by lepton number violating effects, and that probably is hopeless. And then the three masses of neutrinos. Now, the interesting thing about the neutrino masses is that the oscillations only tell us something about mass difference of mass squared. It doesn't tell us about the absolute mass. The best thing about the absolute mass we have right now is the fact that the electron mass has to be less than 1 or 2 electron volts from direct decay of tritium. Otherwise, we don't know. We have no idea. Okay, which is very, very, very interesting, I guess.
Why aren't there three Majorana?
Three masses. Masses are masses.
No, but you say two more.
Oh no, two more if it's a Majorana mass. Two more CP violating angles. I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, excuse me. Two more CP violating angles. What happens is that when you have a 3x3 matrix, you can get rid of a lot of the phases by reabsorbing in some fields. That's what happens in CKM. But if some of these fields have Majorana masses, you cannot reabsorb it, and they reappear at you. But they only reappear because of this stuff. So they appear suppressed actually by powers of mass over energy, and etc. And it's basically forget it, I think. Okay. Now, what is the future of this field? Well, as you know, there's a lot of work, a lot of thing about a National Underground Laboratory. Senator Daschle is senator from South Dakota, which happens to be where the mine is. So there had been a push, headed, I think, by John Bacall, to actually use the Homestake mine as a national underground laboratory. What's happening in that mine is that it's about to be flooded. And the reason is because it's no longer profitable. I think they mine, forget what they mine, gold, I guess. Yeah, it's not profitable, okay? Should mine euros or something, anyway. And now what happens to a mine when you stop using it? It gets flooded. And because water seeps through, and so the question is that the Ray Davis lab is halfway in between. I mean, it's not at the deepest level. So the plan right now is to flood up to a certain thing, and then keep that part unflooded. And and set it up as a national underground laboratory. There are other proposals from down the coast here, the proposals from UCLA to use nuclear waste dump sites, etc. But at least to have some sort of an underground laboratory. The second possibility is intense neutrino beams, which would come with having muon. This is the ideas of the neutrino factory and everything else. I don't know about that one. This one looks more interesting, because what happens is that one thing I haven't spoken about, but we are clearly on the threshold of this era, is the era of neutrino astronomy. I mean, this is a big stuff, in a sense that we are learning more and more that, for example, we now understand neutrinos from the sun. This is our closest friend, etc. But as it is, we know already that we benefited from a supernova not too far away. God knows what else. We should monitor neutrinos. In fact, right now, detectors on Earth are linked together to look for supernovas. They have a supernova network, okay? All right? And then eventually, long after I and perhaps maybe most of you here will measure the cosmic neutrino background, but I don't think that will happen right away. Because as you know, we've got lots of neutrinos around, not only neutrinos coming from the sun, but the guys in there. And it means that at some point, if we get to be very good at detecting neutrinos, as good as we are now detecting photons, eventually at some point we will get a great deal of information about our world from neutrinos. What is this? Ah, finally, excuse me, I misjudged. I have to learn how to put here a little quicker. So the neutrino masses tell us something, a particle physics note. There's something beyond the Stannard model. Psychologically, we all knew there was. I mean, all of us work on things beyond the Stannard model, okay, but it's good to know. The tiny masses lead to two possibilities as far as with, you know, rough stuff, either low-energy supersymmetry or low-energy brains, okay? Or maybe in one of these, for example, a possibility I would say is a third possibility, which I should have mentioned here, is the kind of model that Tony likes, Tony advocated a long time ago, which gives you scales a little bit higher than that. Okay? But either way, if I take this optimistic point of view, okay, that means the Stannard model Higgs is not alone. That means in that range, in the TEV range, there's going to be something. Because the way to generate the small scale for neutrinos, okay, I think the two of these ways that I mentioned actually tell you that there is something, whether it's brains, whether it's low-energy supersymmetry, I don't know. But up to now, there existed the real possibility that the Stannard model was complete. You could just have the Higgs, happens to be, say, at 140 GeV, and it's just sitting there all by itself. There's nothing that contradicts theory right now. But now, I think there is something more. Therefore, this is where we are, and thank you very much.
Questions, please? Questions?
No.
Okay, Lars?
Do you think there's any particle physics to be learned from the large underground work being done on the poles, such as the Proto-Manta?
Amanda and company. Well, maybe more astrophysics than particle physics, I think.
So that's a relative statement. But you don't think there's any particle physics?
Oh, no, no, of course not. Anything to be known. I mean, there's an issue that I've not spoken about. I mean, this is something that we'd be looking for, neutrinos coming from out there. I mean, way out there. You know, I don't know. I mean, there are many issues that I haven't spoken about. Like, for example, before the Snow result, there was this issue of sterile neutrinos. Maybe there are not only three active neutrinos, the three neutrinos we already know about, but there's another species which takes away probability. It's like a leak in your Hilbert space. You just basically invent a new particle that takes out the probability for you, okay? And so far, the Snow measurements seem to indicate that, at least roughly speaking, there is no obvious leak. You don't have to call a plumber yet. So what happens is that given that there are only these neutrinos coming out, I mean, so far, you know, I don't know. I'm not, I think it would be important in a sense, I guess, that maybe neutrinos coming from astrophysical objects or things like that. But in terms of particle physics, I don't know if they can really give a better determination.
Well, I mean, the value of the solar neutrino part of physics was that the afterphysics, by the time the measurement was made, was relatively certain.
Right.
And so you could actually turn the problem around.
Right.
Well,
but I think perhaps the
geometry is which allows you to do it. You don't need to know any afterphysics. The geometry tells you something going on. But the question is, do you see any such power in Amanda or IQ of that nature?
No, I think it's more, I personally view it more importantly as a way of monitoring sources, which by itself is far more interesting in a sense. Just like looking for, you know, weird sources of gravitational radiation or something like that. I mean, weird neutrino emissions, something like that, I think is just fantastically, I don't know. In terms of the actual setting up parameters, now it could be that, you know, how long did it take to measure all the Kabibo angle, all the Kabibo Kobayashi Maskawa properties? It took quite a long time. And well, we've done one.
We haven't done the full matrix.
No. I know. So we know probably one angle, give or take 10%. We know another one, give or take a factor of two, the solar neutrino one. But we don't even know in which flavor it mixes. So the only one we know more or less for certain, nu mu to nu tau, and that's it. And the rest we don't know. So all these things have to be yet to be done. Now the question that becomes important is, which is, that's another thing I did not talk about, is that could it be, this from the theory standpoint, is that, you know, with how much precision must you know these things for theory? Now, there's something interesting. The angle of the super K people in the atmospheric is naively, you know, looks like it could be quite large. Suppose it's maximal. Suppose it's 45 degrees. Okay? We have no theory to handle 45 degrees. I don't know of any theory that will tell you, you know, really this is what it is. I mean, this, so that would be, so if you get a precision measurement, if you start getting precision measurements, you know, and you find that the mixing is really maximal or really near maximal with great accuracy, that's got to be a guide. But I wish I knew what it told me. But it's undoubtedly going to say something very important. Okay? Because it means you don't think of an electron neutrino of a muon neutrino anymore. I mean, because it's neither nor, right? It's very...
Okay, Lars, my impression of Amanda and Ice Cube, from what little I know, is that Ice Cube really almost should be thought of as a pilot project for something. I mean, it's large in itself, but it's still not large enough to observe localized neutrino sources. You just get an integrated neutrino rate and spectrum. Mm-hmm. So you're not imaging anything in a way.
Not yet. Not yet.
At all. So it's sort of a first or maybe second step along, you know, the way. But I think of it really as predominantly astrophysics interest rather than particle physics.
Yeah.
There is one particle physics thing that might be.
Can you speak up, please? So people
in the back. Sorry. One particle physics possibility is that if the dark matter is some heavy stable particle, and it can para-annihilate into high-energy neutrinos.
Well, sources of neutrinos. Yeah, I mean, now we go back to the question of sources of neutrinos. That's extremely important, of course. I mean, that's why, I mean, the question of, you know, new sources of neutrinos is what we're looking for, what we would like to have. Absolutely. I mean, that's, yeah. So we don't need, photons are not enough. Neutrinos are needed now. So that's why I meant neutrino astronomy is. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, other questions, I thank you.
Thank you. All right.